It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, does 1 hour of exercise really offset a whole day of sitting? Is running bad for our knees? We'll talk to the author of a new book about how our bodies have evolved and how that affects modern work and modern exercise. First, the combination of political turmoil, an economic recession, and a pandemic are having an effect on our overall mental well-being. A Kaiser Family Foundation survey taken over the summer found 53% of adults said the pandemic took a negative toll on their mental health. Some mental health experts say in these tough times it can be a good idea to check in with ourselves. And our next guest has advice on how to do that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how to check in on your own mental well-being? Is this something you've done yourself? What have you noticed changing over the last year? Were you able to find ways to spot problems and deal with them along the way? Share what worked for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Shyla Mergain is a distinguished psychologist at UW Health. She specializes in individual and couples therapy with patients with mood, anxiety disorders, and adjustment issues. Shyla, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. Thrilled to be here.
Well, I often hear advice, you know, check in with loved ones, see how they're doing, friends, whatever. Why is it important to kind of do a self-check of our mental health?
These are some challenging times. Just a year ago, we had the first case of COVID arriving in the U.S., and a year later, we're passing this tremendous milestone of over 400,000 deaths, which we're about to reach the more deaths than happened in World War II. And people are really feeling quite burned out by this pandemic. And as a result, people's mental health is really struggling. And it's so important to safeguard our mental health by being proactive. Here in Wisconsin, these are these tough months of winter where many people are vulnerable to the winter blues in a normal year. But on top of that, some of our regular coping strategies aren't available. We can't escape to the movies. We can't go out to dinner with friends. We have to still have these safeguards to protect our health as the vaccine is slowly being distributed, but not to everyone. So we really want to prioritize emotional fitness this year by being proactive and setting short-term goals.
One thing that it seems to me would make this difficult is, unlike a natural disaster, a one-off event, a loss of a loved one, where one thing happened and then we respond to it maybe by being depressed or sad afterwards. This is such a slow burn that, I don't know, behaviors can change slowly, mindsets can change slowly. It can sneak up on us, can't it?
Absolutely. It's kind of like a slow drip that can lead to some maladaptive behaviors over time. And I think that as the pandemic persists, and although we see some light at the end of the tunnel in terms of the summer, the fall, things getting back to normal, we know we have these challenging months ahead that we have to get through. And we can feel like, oh, I just want to sit in my PJs and binge watch on Netflix and eat too much, which is the exact opposite of what we want to do. And I think as we're talking, we can really encourage people to think about emotional fitness and setting some small short-term goals. Because one of the best things we can do is really focus on some simple, specific things that we can do so we don't feel so helpless to get ourselves back in the driver's seat. And just self-care, you know, making sure, especially this time of year, we're eating well, we're sleeping, we're exercising, spending time with loved ones, getting outside. I think about kind of putting those things front and center. They may be the most important things we do to really create that good foundation for ourselves. So we arrive on the other side of this doing well versus feeling really beaten up by the pandemic.
Let's talk about those goals, small goals you said. What kind of things do you have in mind?
Well, I think about it in a couple different ways. The first thing is, what can I do between now and springtime to get myself through these dark days of winter? Am I doing some of that basic self-care that I talked about? But also, am I doing some things to spark my joy? Do I have maybe once a week a pleasant activity I can look forward to that can really occupy my days? And it's also really important to not socially isolate. In winter, we want to hibernate like a bear in a cave and stick to ourselves and under the covers on our couch. But instead, it's really important to nurture relationships and to take the initiative to reach out to people who are important and find creative ways to connect. And the last area that I think is a really fun one to focus on is something that I call and others call GEMS, that are incorporating goals of enjoyment and mastery into your routine. And this is why it's important, Rob. When we are, you know, typically going about our life pre-pandemic, we would have all these encounters with people randomly in the grocery store, in the workplace, or at the PTA meeting. And those random encounters would boost our mood. But we are really, we don't have those naturally occurring very much. You know, in the grocery store, we're not interacting with people with those masks for fear there might be a transmission of COVID. So GEMS are to incorporate goals of enjoyment and mastery into your day and into your routine. So simple things for your simple enjoyment. And simple things where you feel a sense of mastery that give you a sense of accomplishment. And it could be something as simple as maybe you create an art project, or maybe you cook a new dish, or maybe you do a woodworking project, or maybe you help a neighbor. But when you get that accomplishment, that can equally boost your mood, as similar to those interpersonal interactions. So it's a great way to really stabilize our mood and also give us a sense of achievement during this time, which is really important for mental health.
Talking to Shyla Morgane, a psychologist at UW Health, talking about doing a mental health check during COVID. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found those little things that Shyla was just talking about, the things that feel like give you a sense of accomplishment, those little goals, those little joys in life? Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. On the flip side, Shyla, how can we tell when we're kind of doing this self-check if we're sliding into a place that it's going to take more than a little joy, where maybe we need to talk to somebody, seek out whatever kind of help might be available? What are some red flags we can watch for in ourselves?
Yeah, that's such a great question, Rob, because we know we need a safety net and early intervention is key. So I think people really want to look at their mood. Am I starting to get into a slump where I'm starting to feel down, or I'm not interested in things or enjoying things as much, or maybe I'm feeling really overcome with anxiety or even grief? You know, people are experiencing considerable losses, whether it's the death of somebody or financial concerns like the loss of a job and worrying about putting food on the table. So looking at mood and then looking at intensity and chronicity. So is that mood just a bad day or even a bad couple days, or am I finding myself in those more distressing emotional states for most of the day, nearly every day? And then I also look at impairment and distress. Is it causing a lot of distress to me or maybe my loved ones around me? Or is it causing some impairment, like I'm not able to function at work, or I'm snapping at my spouse, or I'm not opening my mail, so getting behind in my bills? So looking at some of those factors, and when we start to see that there is kind of a pattern and frequency of this, that's really a warning sign to get help. And again, early intervention is key. I think the first thing is just tell somebody safe, somebody who cares about you. Hey, I'm struggling. Can you listen to me? There's balm to the soul when we can share to somebody safe what we're going through. And sometimes that can help reboot us. But also knowing that there is professional help out there. You're not alone. Talking to your primary care physician or calling a behavioral health specialist. Behavioral health specialists across the state are providing telehealth, so you can do some counseling from the comfort of your own home, and it's confidential.
We are talking about doing a mental health self-check in this tough time. Shyla Morgane stays with us, psychologist at UW Health, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Has the past year been rough for your own mental health? Have you found ways to cope? Have you found some of those little things in your life that give you the boost, a goal, a hobby maybe, an intentional way of keeping in touch with other people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about how to have a mental health self-check and how to boost your mental well-being during a tough time with psychologist Shyla Morgane from UW Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you done to give yourself a mental or emotional boost? What does self-care mean to you in these times? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Brian is with us in Milwaukee. Brian, hello.
Oh, hi. So I called in because I'm just a little worried about the trivializing of chronic conditions in these times, because even professionals are starting to say things like, well, everyone's going through something, but some people were going through things before and are even worse off now.
Brian, thank you so much for bringing that up. That's something we've talked about on the show in the past, but Shiley, it's a great point. Some people came into the pandemic with maybe anxiety or depression, and I assume for many of them that's made things worse.
Absolutely, Brian. I'm so happy you brought that up, because whether it's a mental health condition or a physical condition that was occurring prior to the pandemic, it can add an extra complexity or layer. And I really appreciate you putting voice to that of recognizing and validating that. And, you know, as I was talking earlier, some of the coping strategies that people use in treatment of a psychological condition or medical condition, many of those are not available or have not been available or limited, which can make it even more complex. Really creating a good plan for yourself is really important, and getting the kind of support you need. It's challenging. I think really recognizing that is important.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Sherry next, calling from Soldiers Grove. Sherry, hello.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Sherry?
I just wanted to say, you know, I've been doing really okay through this pandemic. I've just been building a house for the last few years with help from many friends, and I have a long list of things that need to be done for that. So I'm checking those off as I go, listening to my music.
You're breaking up, Sherry. I'm sorry. I was tracking you at the beginning there, but I kind of lost where you're going with that. Thank you. Sorry about that. Sherry had an ongoing project, was the part of that I caught, Shyla. Something like that. I'm not going to start building a house now, but starting something new, a new hobby or a long-term project might be a way to, get those daily gems, as you were talking about.
Exactly. And I think about after the 1918 epidemic, the Roaring Twenties came about, the time of tremendous creativity. And experts are really predicting a similar kind of creativity occurring on the other side of this pandemic. So having something you're building, I heard Sherry say music, of, you know, fostering some creativity, things that ignite a sense of joy that allow you to create something, I think is going to be a really important life during this time.
Thanks for that call. We heard from Charlie in Madison, who says it's important to validate your own suffering, even if others may be hurting more than you. And I think this is a common thought process for me, Shyla. What am I complaining about at any given time in my life? Somebody out there has things way worse. How do we get a good midpoint of that kind of perspective, but I guess not dismissing stuff that can be troubling us in our lives?
Yeah, we don't want to trivialize what we're going through, but really recognizing and offering some space for our own experience. Certainly, there'll always be people who are doing better or worse than us, but it can be really helpful to provide that kind of acknowledgement to ourselves. And, you know, I think a simple practice is just some self-compassion or being kind to yourself with a simple mindful self-compassion break can be really powerful, based on the work of Kristen Neff, a researcher in mindful self-compassion. And that's quite simply, when you are struggling, when you're feeling kind of down or feeling overwhelmed or scared or frustrated, to just acknowledge it in the moment, maybe taking a simple breath in and out to bring your mind in the moment so you're here now, and then just doing a kind word or gesture of kindness. You might put your hand on your heart or hand on your cheek and just acknowledge, this is tough. You know, this is a hard moment. This is a painful moment. This is a moment of struggle, but I'll get through this, and offer yourself almost even imagine, you know, somebody who cares about you showering you with that compassion. You can offer yourself that same gift, and that can really help shift an emotional state to more balance and calm and perspective and resilience. So you're getting back in touch with, yeah, it's a tough moment, but I've gone through tough moments. I can get through that. I can get through this. And that really helps strengthen our core to really have the stamina to get through the next couple months till we're on the other side of this.
So I've mostly been thinking of this in terms of adults checking in on themselves. Do you have thoughts for parents who want to help their kids? And maybe their kids don't have, you know, the words to name what they're feeling, but their lives are clearly disrupted now. What would you say to parents to do a kid check on mental health?
Yeah, that's great. I think a couple different things. The first is doing some emotion coaching based on the work of John Gottman and emotion coaching versus emotion dismissing. So if you notice a child's upset, you can act as a mirror and just notice it, saying, I notice Johnny or Susie, you're upset, but then validate it. You might have to put words on the emotion. It looks like you're angry or sad or scared, and then just listen. Listen to what they might be sharing, you know, what's going on. Sometimes you have to take a walk or take a drive to have that child open up. But I think the biggest gift parents can give their kids is just reassurance, offering safety, saying, you know, we're going to stay safe. I'm here for you. You know, I love you. That kind of solid support is what kids need, because then they can just relax and be kids.
Time for one more caller. We've got Kim on the line in Eau Claire. Kim, hi.
Hello. Early pandemic, my wife's a wonderful seamstress, so we made several thousand masks and donated them to facilities that needed masks.
And how did that make you and your wife, Kim, feel?
It was very gratifying, especially when we couldn't do a whole lot. My wife is a retired marriage and family therapist, so... that was a way to feel like we were doing something, whether while we were stuck at home.
Kim, thanks a lot for that call. Shiloh, let's talk about that for our last few moments, the value of, you know, taking action to help others.
Oh, Kim, thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, what a blessing and gift that you were able to make all those masks. And that gift of generosity, again, one of the ways to really strengthen our overall all well-being is to focus outside of ourselves on doing good for somebody else. It could be a random act of kindness or expressing gratitude for somebody or doing something that will really help somebody. But research shows that when we are doing something that is kind or generous to others, they benefit, but we even benefit more. It boosts our mood, and that effect lingers for a while. And I think about it as, you know, this almost like a daily emotional checklist that we can do of just thinking about who am I connecting with and who am I checking in on? Number one, am I moving my body today? Can I get outside or connect with nature? If I can't get outside, can I look at some nature indoors? How am I expressing my creativity? What kind of self-care am I needing? Am I needing to hydrate or rest a little bit or eat some nutritious food? And then lastly, kind of thinking about gratitude. What can I be grateful for? You know, is there somebody I can express that gratitude for or do some generous acts towards? Those kinds of questions can be really helpful.
That's a good place to leave it. Shiloh, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Shiloh Morgain is a psychologist, at UW Health, joining us with advice on how to do a mental health self-check in a difficult year. It's been 1 year since the first case of COVID-19 was confirmed in the U.S., and thousands of Wisconsinites continue to test positive every day. While there's no silver bullet for avoiding hospitalization, Bram Sable-Smith reports that experts have developed tips for treating the disease.
Morgan Siner struggled to decide whether to drive from Waterloo to Marshfield to visit family for Christmas. The 29-year-old knew traveling risked exposure to the coronavirus. On the other hand, she had a really hard year. Like a lot of us, she missed family milestones while spending the year in isolation.
And I think I just got overconfident, and I went up to visit my sister and her husband and their kids.
It was a good Christmas, but 2 days later, she got the call. Her sister had symptoms. Siner got tested herself, and the results came back on New Year's Day. She had COVID-19.
That just goes to show you can be so careful, and you can just make one mistake. You can just let your guard down a little bit and that's when it could get you.
Wisconsin saw a spike in new cases after the holidays, and while there's no cure for COVID, experts have developed a decent sense for what helps. Siner and her husband followed many of these practices, and they hope their experience can help others. Step one is isolating. Siner's husband Andrew did not travel and tested negative for COVID. They wanted to keep it that way, so he slept on the couch. UW Health's Nasia Softar says that's a good start.
So ideally a dedicated room and a bathroom if that's available. If it isn't possible, then I think everyone in the house should be wearing masks when they're around you if you're sick.
That includes the sick person too. And Softar says other basic hygiene is important, like hand washing, cleaning high-touch surfaces, and keeping air circulating with open windows, fans, or air purifiers.
The aerosols that sort of hang around in the air, it's good to move around the air so that it can waft them away, whether it's natural or artificial.
Step two, monitor your symptoms. So far, Morgan Siner has not had a fever, but she checks it twice a day. Michael Landrum from Bellin Health in Green Bay says that's a good idea. He also suggests using something called a pulse oximeter. It's about $30 and can be bought online or at a pharmacy. It clips to a fingertip and measures your blood oxygen level.
That's important because that's really one of the prime warning signs that things could be getting worse.
Landrum says a typical blood oxygen level is around 98 to 99%. If you have COVID and it dips below 94 and doesn't get better when you take a few deep breaths,
then that should be a sign that at least call your doctor.
Shortness of breath and other breathing difficulties may also signal that COVID is progressing to a point that might need hospitalization. A pulse oximeter can help detect that early. Step three, treat your symptoms. The only real remedy Morgan Siner used was a bottle of nasal spray, but she also ate healthy, got rest, and drank liquids. Landrum says, right on.
The old adages you got from your mom or grandma are still true with this.
If you do develop a fever, both Landrum and Softar say you should treat it with a fever reducer, like ibuprofen or Tylenol. Either one is fine and should help other likely symptoms like muscle aches. There's also some evidence that people with low levels of vitamin D are more likely to contract COVID or develop more severe symptoms. A vitamin D supplement could be helpful, but just to bring your levels up to normal. And Softar says there's one more treatment to ask your doctor about, monoclonal antibodies. That's the IV treatment President Trump got back in October.
Not everyone needs them, but if you have high-risk conditions, it's good to at least discuss the possibility of should you be getting those.
Morgan Siner is out of isolation now. She still feels guilty about contracting COVID, but she's thankful her symptoms weren't worse. Bram Sablesmith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, an evolutionary biologist explores the many myths of exercise and tells us why we shouldn't feel bad when we don't want to do it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent for a look at presidential transitions, how they usually work, and what's different this time around. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, in a world where office jobs and TV watching are the norm, we assume that exercise is good and necessary and that we should want to exercise. Now, we sometimes feel bad when we don't want to exercise. Entire industries have popped up to encourage us to get active. From special clothing to wear, equipment to buy, and gyms and clubs where we pay money to wear ourselves out. But in human evolution, the modern form of exercise is a pretty new concept. It's something our ancestors might have been baffled by, and our next guest says we can get more benefit from exercise if we realize how, in some ways, unnatural it is. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Does exercise come naturally to you, or do you have to struggle to get yourself to do it? What questions do you have about how it works, how much, how little, what kind of exercise we should be doing? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Lieberman is the Edwin M. Lerner II Professor of Biological Sciences in the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University. His new book is called Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Well, this fundamental idea, it's right there in your subtitle. we did not evolve to exercise, at least not the way we think of exercise these days. Why not?
Well, it's important to make a distinction between physical activity, which is just moving, right? You know, when you go to the supermarket and get stuff or go climb a tree because you want to get a cat out of it or whatever, right? That's just physical activity. But exercise is a special kind of physical activity. It's discretionary. It's voluntary. It's unnecessary physical activity that we plan to do for the sake of health and fitness. And until recently, people had to be physically active, but they also were limited in calories. And so they avoided physical activity when it wasn't beneficial, when it didn't have any sort of immediate need or wasn't fun.
And you spend a lot of time in the book and in your career looking to a modern hunter-gatherer societies for, you know, an idea of what all of our ancestors who are hunter-gatherers, how they might have behaved, the kind of work they do. You've been all over the world looking at this. And yeah, in talking to people, this idea that you would run, but you weren't chasing or being chased by something is baffling to people who aren't living and are sitting in a desk world.
Yeah, it's true. I love to ask people, you know, and there are cultures, you know, like the famous Tarahumara who do run long distances, or in Kenya, where I've done most of my field work, where we work with in the area where a lot of the world's best runners come from. And when you ask people, you know, when do you run? They look at me like, well, when a goat gets loose, you know, that's when they run. But going for like a 5-mile jog in the morning, which is what I like to do, they think I'm crazy. Nobody does that. And, you know, if you think about it, it makes sense. Because for most people until recently, and for many people still on the planet, you know, they don't have an unlimited supply of energy, of calories. And so calories you spend, you know, going for a 5-mile jog, that's 500 calories, is calories you don't spend taking care of your body or helping, you know, your children. So it's kind of a strange thing that we do today, but we never used to do.
And this isn't just an academic exercise. You're looking at this to learn about how we in the United States say how we can get motivated to do kinds of physical activity that are healthy for us. If we don't understand how weird this concept of exercise is, it's going to be harder to get us to motivate ourselves. How can learning from these other societies help us out here?
Exactly. Well, here's the thing, right? In the United States, the way we get people to exercise is we have two ways to do it. One is we've industrialized it, we've commodified it, we've commercialized it, right? We sell exercise and we buy exercise and we go to the gym and whatever. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But that's one of the ways we do it. And then the other way we do it is we've medicalized it. We prescribe it, exercise is medicine. And the evidence is out there, right? We know that these two different ways in which we try to get people to exercise just basically doesn't work all that well. According to many, many different government agencies and other studies, only about 20% of adult Americans get 150 minutes a week of physical activity, of moderate to vigorous physical activity. So that's like a brisk walk, right? That's 21 minutes a day, right? And that's 150 minutes a week is what every major organization in the world, health organization in the world, considers to be the minimum amount of physical activity somebody should get. So if only 20% are doing it on this sort of medicalized, commercialized perspective, we need to try a different tack. And I think that an evolutionary and anthropological approach can help us do better.
Now, one telling thing in your book for me, I've got a treadmill in my basement. I got it for free and I use it, you know, when I can't get outside for a walk. Once upon a time, the treadmill was part of a prison sentence. People were confined and made to walk on treadmills as a punishment.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. If you think treadmill is torture, you're in good company because the treadmill was actually invented by a man named William Cubitt. He was hired to produce. You know, they were worried that prisoners in Victorian jails in England were kind of relaxing too much and not being punished enough. So they created this treadmill to make people trudge for hours and hours and hours. And you know, people like Oscar Wilde, for example, were required to trudge on treadmills for hours and hours and hours. So if you don't like a treadmill, and I put people on treadmills for a living, but I don't enjoy them much either. And if you feel it's a form of torture, there's a reason.
Talking to Daniel Lieberman about his new book, Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you naturally like to do physical activity and exercise? Do you motivate yourself to do it even though it's a chore, or have you just kind of run into a brick wall trying to find the thing that works for you? Share your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You look at exercise and physical activity, Daniel, and you also look at inactivity and, you know, sitting. And I'm one of these people, I hear sitting's bad. Okay, I stand and host the show. I have standing workstations. But in looking at these other cultures, hunters and gatherers and elsewhere, they sit a lot too. Tell us what you learned from how and when they sit.
Yeah, well, so I start the book off by thinking about physical inactivity, because if you want to understand activity, you also have to understand inactivity. And you can't exercise all day long, right? You know, and the reason I called the book Exercised is, to be exercised, to be anxious, nervous, worried, harassed, confused, right? And we have made people exercised about the topic of physical activity and inactivity. And a good example is sitting, right? We've demonized sitting. We say it's like the new smoking. Your chair is out to kill you, you know, and you can read all kinds of horrible statistics out there about how smoking is, you know, sitting is, you know, unnatural. But I think most people know that instinctively that smoking and sitting aren't the same thing, and that sitting is nowhere as near as harmful as smoking. And it turns out that it's also not unnatural. If you go into a hunter-gatherer camp or a village of farmers, places like where I work, people are sitting most of the time when they're not working, and they're not working crazy hard. So hunter-gatherers work about 2.25 hours a day. The rest of the time, they're in camp sitting. So sitting itself isn't so bad, or it's not unnatural. It's just that there are better and worse ways to sit. So rather than demonizing sitting, why don't we give people the real information that they need to know, which is that break up your bouts of sitting so that you don't sit for long, uninterrupted periods of time, and also try to sit more actively. It turns out it's helpful to, you know, squat or not have a chair with a back, etc. So using some of your muscles. And, you know, evidence shows that it's not work time sitting that's associated with poor health outcomes. It's leisure time sitting. So if you work all day at a desk, don't panic, because if you get home, you know, you can go do a little bit of physical activity, you know, go for a half hour walk or something like that. You're gonna do fine.
You tackle in each chapter, really, the book, myths about exercise and inactivity. One of them has to do, getting back to motivation here, with the idea of just do it. Just do it as an effective tool of motivation, not such an effective strategy. Why not?
Well, the evidence shows it doesn't work. If you just tell people to exercise, that's not going to get them to exercise. We just know that, right? And I think there's a deep and fundamental reason for that, because for millions of years, for thousands and thousands of generations, right, people struggled to get enough food, right? And to get the food, they had to be physically active. But to then spend extra energy on physical activity that didn't have any kind of benefit wasn't helpful, right? So it was selected against. So we evolved to be physically active for two reasons and two reasons only. One is when it's necessary, and the other is when it's rewarding, especially socially rewarding. So, like, for example, going for a dance, right? Where you get to show off and meet people and form social bonds, or play. That's another form of physical activity that's rewarding, right? And that helps build skills, and we teach each other not to be, you know, bad sports and stuff like that. So if we want to help each other be physically active, we have to find ways to make it both necessary and socially rewarding. And the best way to do that is make it fun and make it social and make it playful, or use commitment contracts. You know, one idea is to treat exercise like education. Education is as abnormal as exercise, right? Nobody learned geology or geography or you know, algebra or, you know, states capitals back in the old day, right? But how do we make school work? We make it necessary, and we also make it fun. We make it social, and there's also, you know, all kinds of things that make kids want to go to school. We should treat exercise exactly the same way.
We're talking to Daniel Lieberman, professor of biological sciences in the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard. His new book is called Exercised: Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does exercise come naturally to you? Do you have to struggle to get yourself to do it? Is it a losing battle sometimes? And if you do some of the more extreme athletics, the triathlons, Ironmans, whatnot, why do you do it? Call 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Daniel Lieberman. His new book is called Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences with exercise and motivation. What successfully got you exercising, maybe even if you had to overcome some hurdles to do it? Have you still not found what you're looking for when it comes to exercise? 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Wendy is with us in Algoma. Wendy, hi. Do we have Wendy? We don't have Wendy. Let's go to James then in Spooner. James, hello.
Hello.
James, hi. Greetings. What did you want to bring up?
Yes, I just wanted to call in and let you know what motivated me. Basically, a couple of years before this COVID thing happened, I kind of upped my exercise routine. And what I have a tendency to do is read scriptures, do a little bit of meditation. Then I put some praise music or just music on because I'm a musician, too. And I do an exercise routine for about 45 minutes to an hour. I do 277 sit-ups, 77 push-ups, 77 deep knee bends, some hurdler stretches and leg lifts and stuff to go with. Now, I do it or got my motivation kind of from the fact or my belief that my body is the temple of God, and I try to do maintenance to his temple every day. It helps me keep from having depression. It helps me be happy, and my quality of life for the day, for today, is
James,
better.
Thank you so much for sharing that. You gave us a lot to work with there. First of all, Daniel, you were talking about reward. Part of what will motivate us to do exercise is reward. James saying his reward, it sounds like, is he realizes he feels better. His mood is better. His depression goes away. Is that part of the thing that can help us get motivated?
Well, absolutely. Well, here's the thing, right? First of all, it's wonderful that James is got this fantastic routine and it's clearly working for him.
Yeah.
The problem is that a lot of people struggle to get into that kind of mode, right? Into that kind of routine. And one of the problems is that the reward that you get from exercise, what makes James feel great after exercise, all the good stuff happens after you exercise, not before you exercise. So dopamine is the neurotransmitter that gets released and synthesized, when we're physically active, and that's the molecule of more. That's the neurotransmitter which says, "Do it again. That was awesome," right? The problem is that dopamine doesn't happen before you do it. It happens after you do it. So people struggle to kind of get that, right? And like, I'm no different. I mean, in the morning when I go for a run, I'm mostly a runner, right? I often don't want to leave, right? But I know that when I get back, I'll be glad I did it. And I kind of coerce myself. I meet a friend, and then I have to be there at 6 a.m. on the corner of the street, where I live, to meet him. But it's the problem is that most people are struggling to get where James is at. And I think that what we need to do is compassionately help them do it. Virtue signaling is not effective, right? Letting people know just how good people have like the 26.2 stickers on the back of their car. That doesn't help people run, right? It just kind of makes people irritated, I suspect. So we need to find ways to be compassionate and understand that people who don't exercise, they're not lazy. There's nothing wrong with them. They're actually normal. They're completely normal human beings.
Another point James brought up is that he's motivated in part here by his faith. And that reminds me, some of the societies you looked at, the physical activity that isn't directly connected to survival often has some kind of ritual or maybe spiritual purpose. Is there something we can learn from that, whether we're drawing on our spirituality or creating exercise rituals, even if they're secular in nature, to get us motivated?
Absolutely. I mean, I had the good fortune of spending a lot of time doing research with some Native American groups, the Tarahumara in Mexico, and they are famous for these long distance runs. And what people don't often know about them is that their main motivation for these long runs is it's a form of prayer. It's beautiful. It's spiritual. It's really moving. And so it's a way that shows that physical activity for them is meaningful. It's right. And how many kids in America grow up thinking, that they want to, show their faith or whatever by you know, running long distances. It's just not something that we do, right? But for almost every Native American peoples, that's an important, running is an important part of sort of their spirituality, of their existence. And I think we can learn a lot from that. It's wonderful.
Thanks for the call, James. Gave us a lot to talk about there. Talking to Daniel Lieberman about his book, Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. All right, so just do it isn't going to get us going. Shaming each other isn't going to get us going. You've started to touch on this, the social aspects, the fun aspects for that person who's just not feeling it, not getting that exercise. How can they evaluate themselves and figure out the kind of things that are going to work for them?
Well, I mean, I think we all know what we enjoy, right? I mean, I think that, you know, the problem is that a lot of the prescriptions that we get, you know, are like taking cod liver oil, right? And you know, that's not fun either, but at least it gets over in a few seconds, right? You just gulp it down, you deal with the nasty flavor, and then you're on your way, right? But exercise is a more prolonged and a harder sort of barrier to overcome. So the trick is to find something you enjoy doing. So if you don't like being on a treadmill, or you can't find a podcast or a TV show to watch that makes it enjoyable, find something else that you find enjoyable or fun. So that's I think the first thing. Secondly, you don't need to do a huge amount. Data show that just a little bit is incredibly beneficial. If you just exercise, if you're not exercising at all, just a few minutes a day can have enormous benefits. So some is better than none, and you don't need to run a marathon or do 170 something push-ups or whatever, which is great, but you don't need to do that. And then the final thing is, think about a commitment contract, right? This is how schools work. This is how so many things work, right? Where you can designate somebody as a referee or agree to meet somebody. Like I on Thursday mornings, I meet friends to do intervals. You know, we run on the track, right? And I never want to be there at 7 in the morning on this cold, miserable track, right? But I have to meet them, right? So it's a contract I have with them. And then we cheer each other on and we help each other. And that makes it fun. And it doesn't have to be running. It can be walking. It can be dancing. It can be anything. But commitment contracts have been shown to be extremely effective. And we can, there's so many ways to do them.
Now, there is a big portion of the population that does exercise, and I think thinks a lot about and argues a lot about what the best kind of exercise is. You tackle that problem. What answer do you offer people, those non-exercisers, as to what kind of exercise would be best?
I would encourage we stop thinking that way. I mean, that's part of the medicalization of exercise, right? That it's like there's an optimal dose. You know, like when you take your coronavirus, right? There's a particular dose you have to take. Well, exercise doesn't work that way, right? Everybody's different. We all have different goals, whether you're male or female or young or old or fit or non-fit, whether you're worried about Alzheimer's or osteoporosis or heart disease or whatever. It's all different for all of us. The important thing is to do something. And but if you are going to try to do it as well as possible, it's pretty simple. You know, some is better than none. Cardio is the bedrock of every exercise program, but it's important to do weights a little bit, you know, some strength training, especially as we get older, and just mix it up. And, you know, that's far more important than tuning the dose just right, because there is no optimal dose. That's a fictitious thought.
In our last minute or so, Daniel, you've been all over the world looking at exercise. You started off in life, as I read you, not an exercise guy. Do you feel like you've learned a lot from the people you've worked with around the world?
Oh my gosh, it's been very inspiring and fun and wonderful. I'm very into participant observation. So every time I've gone and studied people doing stuff, I've tried to do it myself. And I found it humbling, but also empowering, because I've learned, you know, if you ever met me, you would not think of me as an athlete. I'm not fast. I'm not strong. I hid in closet during, you know, to avoid gym when I was a kid. You know, I was picked last for every team. And yet I've learned that, you know, just basic normal human physical activity is quite impressive and wonderful. And we're all athletes. We focus too much on elite athletes. We focus too much on weight loss. Just what your average human being can do is marvelous. And here's a final fact for fun. Your average sedentary American, you know, your couch potato, right, is still more active than your average wild chimpanzee.
Well, that's inspiring. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's Daniel Lieberman, professor of biological sciences at Harvard University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, who should be the top priorities as vaccines continue to roll out? We'll find out who's next on the list after seniors and frontline medical workers. You can join in with your thoughts and questions. Plus, it's an Inauguration Day edition of The Week in Washington. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Do you like the color blue, but sometimes you wish there could be like another shade of blue? On the off chance that you do, you are in luck. As reported in the Smithsonian Magazine, there is a new shade of blue now on the consumer market for the first time in 200 years. I think I may have mentioned the initial discovery a few years back. Researchers at Oregon State created this new blue hue pretty much by accident while doing some kind of electrical research. The new pigment of blue is called YINMN blue. It's a catchy name. It's shorthand for the key elements yttrium, indium, and manganese. It's been described as being like cobalt blue or Prussian blue, but more vibrant. It's been in use in electrical coatings for a few years now, and the EPA approved it for consumer use last year. Now it's in production and available for purchase. But don't plan on painting the whole house with it. There's a limited supply, and it's about $180 for a 1.3-ounce tube. I'm not really good at distinguishing between colors. Like, I'm not colorblind, but I often disagree with people about colors, and I am always wrong when that happens. Like the shoes I had that I thought were gray, but everyone else agreed were brown. But from the pictures I've seen, I do feel qualified to say that this YINMN blue is a real pretty color. It's blue news you can use. This is Central Time.